why isn't, and he picked one out, I'll just pick this one, why isn't this goat worried? What does he have? Well, I said, he has enough for right now. But what else does he have? You tell me. He has a shepherd. People, the Lord leads me into green pastures is not a one-time thing. If you translated the Hebrew literally, the Lord keeps on leading me to green pastures. All you have, hear me, right now, is what you need at this moment. Other than the immediate need for a washroom, is anybody lacking something that you absolutely can't continue without at this moment? Why shouldn't you worry about 10 minutes, noon, this afternoon, tonight, or when you get back to where you came from? What will you get when you get there? The pastures for that moment. Worry, said Rabbi Akiba, is dealing with tomorrow's problems with today's pasture. You don't have what it takes to handle tomorrow. You aren't going to get that 1 minute before you get there. And faith, people, Psalm 23 is not about intellect. Faith is believing that I don't have to sweat tomorrow. Plan, yes. Work, yes. Think, yes. I don't have to sweat tomorrow, because when I get to tomorrow, if I follow the shepherd, what happens if the sheep wanders off and doesn't follow the shepherd? You're going to die. That changed my whole life. I had been somebody that always wanted to have tomorrow and the next day in place. And I've learned it ain't like that. All you get is what you need now. And that is, honestly, they call it green pastures, Midbar Chadar, the green wilderness. And honestly, there are times when you see a green tinge. You can't on this slide, but you do see a green tinge. One last one, and then we'll take a break. And I have one really cool one, at least for me it's powerful. Here's that shepherd girl that I spent time with. Now you got to remember, this girl's maybe 13. And she's got this flock of goats. There's sheep too. I don't know exactly where they were. She's sitting up here. I'm across the wadi. And there's an 800-foot drop-off there. Now there's no way I would let my daughter walk along the edge of there, let alone my flock of goats and sheep. And there she sits. It was incredible what kind of responsibility they were given. But then I noticed something. Most of the time, the sheep are led and the shepherd's out in front. But when it starts to get dark, it changes. So I asked about that. Goats are okay. In the dark, sheep do stupid things. A sheep is an animal that will go to the shepherd's voice, even if there's a wadi in between. So if I had been here, and I was the shepherd, by the way, I tried to be a shepherd. I promised those goats alfalfa and cold water with ice in it and an air-conditioned barn. If the girl is killed in a wadi flood, they slaughter the flock, because they won't follow anybody else. That's why she takes her little sister along, because the sheep have to learn to follow the little sister. There's tons of midrash in that too. But if I had called to those sheep, they'd all go right across they'd all jump right in the canyon. You know, from my heart, this is one of the things that I find is the biggest barrier to passionate Jesus followers. I take people, and I was the same, I take people like you to Israel, and I take them on a hike, and we do a climb. And I turn around, and I look, and I've got a whole flock of goats. All these Westerners know a better way. It's easier over here, more fun over here. Fine, you paid for the trip, you can climb anywhere you want. When you follow Jesus, you do not have that option. There's only one path. Would you jump into a wadi if Jesus called you? Now, he will never do that. But if you wouldn't, then you're a Westerner, because you process his call through your head instead of your heart. Anyway, when it gets dark and the shadows come, they say in Hebrew or in Arabic, the shadows come, The shepherds immediately begin to get the sheep out of there because sheep will do stupid things. And I notice something. As it gets dark, the shepherd drops back, and before long, the shepherd is walking right in the middle of the flock. Talk. And those sheep are all clustered around because the shepherd knows the sheep have to be close or they might do... Now listen to the psalm. The Lord leads me, quiet water, leads me to green pastures, leads me to still waters. Said that already. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, except the Hebrew doesn't say the shadow of death. That's an English interpretation. It's a good one. The Hebrew says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the darkest shadow, I will not be afraid, for you are... And at that moment, the shepherd is in the flock. Okay. Question. Yes, sir.
What about the time when
those are tough questions, and I don't necessarily have... I think I'll address that a little bit this afternoon, too. One of the things is this. When you saw that whole line of sheep, here it's a little bit. Shepherd is off somewhere. What does this sheep see? Can't see the shepherd. What do you see? Do you realize that if you're in Jesus' flock, every sheep behind you depends on you? Because if you go off and the one behind you follows you, everybody from there on takes a wrong path. So part of knowing the Lord's path is to be in a flock of sheep with people who are seeking to be on that path. One of the biggest barriers, I think, for me in my life has been those times when I joined a flock that wasn't following the shepherd. And then tried to check out where my shepherd was and run over there once in a while and get a little green pasture and quiet water and then run back and follow something else. I think it's really helpful to be in a community of people and know the Lord's path from the other sheep. The other answer I would give is rabbinic, and I'll do that this afternoon. One more question, we'll take a break. Yes, sir.
With that grass, how long does that stick around?
In a day or two with a hot sun, when the sun hits that grass, it'll look like grass clippings on your sidewalk after a week. Just gone. So by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there's no more grass.
But it grows up overnight.
Overnight. It's like manna. See, and that's it. Why did manna come in the desert? Because you had to learn to depend on God for today. See, now I'll be honest with you, and I think the world, I told you that at the beginning. There are very few of us in this room that do that. Do you know that? You got your refrigerator full, you got your bank account, you got your credit cards, you've got parents standing by, you got scholarships, you got all this stuff. Tell me you woke up this morning and honestly thought, God, if you don't give me what I need today, I'm not going to make it. We're not desert people by nature. We're Greeks. Take a break. I'm going to start again in 7 minutes. So you can take a longer break. I'm not pressuring you. Do what you need to do, and I will start in 7 minutes. Okay, thank you. And I realize somebody made comment up front here that what we do here is sort of Western, and they're very right. You can see how much more powerful it would be if we could spend 2 days out in the desert hiking, following in the distance a shepherd. And how different that would be. That's why the Jewish rabbis always say the true learning happens with your feet, not with your eyes and your ears. So I just bless you for seeing that and for your willingness to put up with a Western-style classroom. I don't know how else to do it. I did come across this picture with a shepherd in the middle of the flock toward afternoon. Notice how she's not leading as much as being with. Anyway, let's move on and do another cultural thing. And I want to take you to a place at the northern edge of that circle where Israel wandered, at a place called Tel Arad. Yeah? Ken? Been to Tel Arad? Now, that was very near the area where Abraham lived. Abraham is Bedouin. Badu in Arabic simply means desert. It's the Arabic word for Midbar. Badu. You can hear Badu, Midbar. Similarity in language. Abraham was a nomad. Today, the nomads are called Bedouin. They're all Muslim. They descend from Ishmael, not from Isaac, but they still live there. I want to show you a chapter of the Bible out of their life. Abraham was living in an area not too unlike this. In that setting, he had been promised the land, both milk and honey. He had been promised children, of whom he had zero. And indirectly, he had been promised the coming of a Messiah. The word is not used, but it's simply that through him, all nations of the world will receive a blessing. And he didn't know, of course, that that all meant the Messiah, but he knew something special was happening. So here was Abraham one day, sitting, it says, in the shade of the tent. Okay? And that's about what he owned. We think of him as a very rich man. Compared to his culture, he was. Compared to you, he would have definitely been on welfare. Now, the text says, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "Don't be afraid. I am your shield, your reward." Now, why would God say that? He needed it in the desert. I like that. But why say it like this? If God came to you, what would he have said to you? I'm not doing very well. This is Eastern. Notice the pictures. I am your shield, and reward literally means your prize money. God is painting a picture to a Jew. Maybe you could say God thinks Hebrew. He doesn't come and say, "Abraham, I'll protect you. And I'm the prize money you're going to need to do whatever you need." God says, "I'm your shield and your prize money." Now you figure out what that means. That's Hebrew. So Abraham is Jewish. It blows my mind. Jewish people have a relationship with God that is intimate and deeply personal, but very honest. There's an enormous difference between the way Christians pray and Jewish people pray. Not reverence. Jews are very reverent. They cover their head always when you pray. You stand, hands extended. I mean, the difference is in how you approach God. Have you seen Fiddler on the Roof? Tevye. "God, I know you're in total control of the..." I'll paraphrase. "Total control of the universe. Everything happens according to your plan. So I know my horse had to get lame. That was part of your plan. I don't understand it, but you had a plan, my horse. But did it have to be on Friday afternoon? Couldn't you have made my horse lame on Sunday or on Monday when I could take..." Why on Friday afternoon did my... Now to us it's like, whoa, you're talking to God. To Abraham I said, "Yeah, it's my dad, it's my father. So I'm going to be honest. I can live with a lame horse, but why on Friday?" Notice Abraham's reaction. If God showed up in your room tonight, literally, and you knew it was God, and he said to you, "I'm going to take care of you and protect you from what's coming," and his voice in silence or in loudness thundered, and you knew you were in the presence of God, I doubt anybody would have said, "But..." But Abraham is Jewish. Abraham says, "Oh, thank you, God, but I don't have any kids. Where's the kids? You promised me kids." Now in Hebrew, that concept is called chutzpah. Actually, it's chatzaf, from the Hebrew chatzufo. It's a verb that means intense persistence, will not quit, will not give up, will never let go. Today, chutzpah isn't a very nice word. It means pushy and assertive and bossy. But in the biblical world, this is one of the words for faith. Faith did not believe to a Jew, "I understand and I believe." Faith meant, "I'm going to latch onto this thing and I will not let go no matter what." Often, Jesus honors people in his life, in their lives, in his ministry, for their persistence. Woman comes to him. She's a Gentile. Jesus has made it clear, "I love the Gentiles, but I came for Jews." First, Gentiles are the next part of God's plan. She brings her daughter. "Rabbi, here's this woman. Kanani." To a Jew, pagan, homosexual. I don't know what it would be in our culture. "My daughter. She's sick." Broke Jesus' heart, I'm sure. Ask him someday. Doesn't say. And Jesus said to the woman, listen, I was sent to Israel. That's my mission. That's what my shepherd God, my father, wants me to do. I can't. Lady, you know the proverb. You don't take food from your children and give it to the dogs. Now, to us, that's a terrible put-down. They don't understand it. That was not a put-down in that culture. He wasn't calling her a dog. The idea was, you don't give dog food to children. You don't give children's food to dogs. You give the food for the one it belongs. And God told me to take care of the Jew. I can't help you. Now, if I'd have been that Canaanite, it would have been like, oh, you Jews and your snot nose, better than you. Who do they think you are? And I'd have walked. The lady said, but Rabbi, it's my daughter. Even the dogs sometimes eat crumbs that the children don't eat. And the Bible says Jesus turned and looked at her and said, I haven't seen, your English says faith, I haven't seen chutzpah like that even among the Jews. Your daughter's better. God loves people who passionately will not let go. Peter, walking on water, sees the wind. Down he sinks. Oh, you of little... See, faith to us means you don't believe much. That's not Jesus. You give up so quick. Peter, what's with you? Where's your chutzpah? I want to be filled with the fire. I will not let go of God. And so Abraham says, okay, God, thank you so much for being my shield and my reward. Bless you. You are. I'm sure he said all those reverent things, if not out loud, then in his head. And then he turned to God and grabbed him by the front of that great robe that's white with a golden sash across his chest, according to Revelation chapter 4. And Abraham said, but God, my kids, you promised me kids. God didn't say, whoa, Abraham. God said, go outside. Look. See him? Yeah, stars. That's what your descendants will be. Notice God honored chutzpah. Then God said, Genesis 15, you can read it yourself. Skip that a moment. Come back to it in a moment. And Abraham, I'm going to give you this land. All of it, the milk and honey. It's yours. Now realize, Abraham was living in a tent. He didn't even own enough land to bury his wife. Abraham, it's all going to be yours. All of it someday. Now what would you have said? Well, Abraham has chutzpah. Look at this. But Abraham said, how will I know for sure that I get this land? Prove it. Tell me that wasn't chutzpah. Now, what happens next is both a covenant and well known in the desert culture to this day. I've seen it with my own eyes. Let me show you. A covenant, if we could have the lights just a little bit more, please. A covenant is a relationship between notice it's a relationship, not an agreement, between a greater and a lesser party, person, party, group of people, or person, single person. People talk about the covenant of marriage, and I'm not against that kind of terminology, but realize in the pure biblical form, marriage is not a covenant unless one is greater, one is lesser. Because a covenant has to be between a greater and a lesser. Now, in covenant, a relationship, the conditions of the relationship in the Middle East are always given by the greater for himself or herself and for the other party. So the greater party says, this is what I'll do and this is what you will do. Now, the lesser party, in class I always call this party B and party A, just because it's easier to say A and B instead of greater and lesser all the time. But the greater party says, I'll do this, and you will do this. You like it? Yep, then that's the way it'll be. Nope, okay, then we don't have a covenant. You can choose not to make the covenant, but the covenant, the conditions are made by the greater for both. Now, what we have in this chapter is a covenant. Notice, God says, okay, earlier, by the way, it's called a covenant, and later you'll see in a moment, it's called a covenant later. God says, here's what I'll do. I'll give you descendants. And one of those descendants will be the Messiah. That's in code, because it's you'll be all the nations of the world will be blessed through you. But I promise, my condition is a Messiah from your descendants. I promise you. Okay? Now, what I want you to do is pretty simple. You walk before me and be blameless. Give me an English word. Okay? All you have to do, Abraham, is be perfect. You be perfect, and I'll give you descendants, one of whom will be the Messiah, and what's more than that, I will give you land. Now, I wish somebody would ask me later about land, because that's a very rich biblical metaphor, too. It's not about real estate, basically. But that also becomes, then, part of God's condition. I will give you descendants, one of whom will be the Messiah, and a place to live in obedience. That's my condition. You be perfect. And Abraham says, okay, let's make a deal. Now comes the covenant, and here's where the culture turns this obscure story into something pretty amazing. Abraham, you want to know for sure? You want this to be a covenant? You want me to guarantee descendants, Messiah, and land? And you're willing to be perfect? Okay, let's make a covenant. Go get me a goat, a ram, a heifer, a pigeon, and a dove. Now remember those five animals. You know what a goat is. The ram is probably a sheep, because it wouldn't make any sense to say, bring me a goat and then a male goat. A ram could be a male goat too, but that doesn't make any sense to me. It's a goat and a ram. What's a heifer? Thank you. First class I've ever had that in here. Nobody knows what a heifer is. It's a female cow that hasn't given birth yet. Okay? Cow that had an abortion is decaffeinated? No, that's terrible. Trying to milk that for all it was worth. You make me feel sheepish. Just trying to pull the wool over your eyes. I'll steer you straight. Bunch of bull anyway. Horns of a dilemma. What's your beef? Bring me a heifer, a goat, a ram, and a pigeon and a dove. Now notice the next part. Very important. It says, and Abraham brought these to him, which is what you'd expect it to say. But then he does more. He takes the animals, he cuts them in half, and arranges the pieces across from each other, except for the birds, which he simply kills. Now, what does that tell you about what's going on? Abraham understood what God was asking. God says, get me the animals. If Abraham didn't get it, he would have brought the animals, put them there, and said, okay, now what? He knew exactly what God was asking. This is a cultural practice used to this day. Now, here's what Abraham did. We could dim the lights a little bit again, please. Here's what Abraham did. He took the animals, he and his family, his servants, whatever, I don't know, maybe he did it by himself. And he killed them, and he cut them in half. There is a group in Israel that still does ceremony like that. And he laid the half cow, half sheep, half goat, and the two dead birds across from each other. The result is the animals bleed, and the blood runs into the middle, collecting and coagulating in what you might call a pool or a path. Now, in the culture, this is called a blood covenant or a blood ceremony. I don't have time today to give you the whole story, but I saw this in the Bedouin family where I lived when they arranged a marriage between the son of a family and the daughter of another family. And I happened to be there at the engagement. And after they had talked through the whole thing, marriage is a covenant, the son being the greater party. The lesser party brought the animals, the girl's dad brought out an animal, cut the animal's throat, the blood ran onto the rock where they had carved what looked like a small manger in the rock, forming a puddle. And then, it just blew my mind, and then first the greater party, the young man's dad, stepped up to the blood, took off his sandals, and stepped in like this. And I mean, the blood flew. I could see it running down his legs. I could see it white on, or red on the white of his robe. I could see it splattering the people who were sitting nearby. He stepped out, and then the girl's father, grandfather probably, stepped up, took his sandals off, and he stepped up. Nobody said a word. Now, I didn't understand all of it, but later I found out that what each was saying is this. The young man's father said, now I made some promises in this covenant. I promised you my son would be, I don't know what, hardworking, non-abusive, a good husband, a good... I don't know what he promised. If he doesn't keep his word, you may do this to me. And I'll tell you something. In the Bedouin culture today, in some countries, Egypt being one, if that guy turned out to be abusive, lazy, and dishonest, you wouldn't find him dead. You'd find his dad with his dad's throat cut in the bottom of a wadi, and there'd be all footprints in the blood. Because his dad said, if I don't keep the covenant, if I don't keep my promise, you may cut my throat and walk in my blood. And then the young woman's dad, she was about 12 years old, same thing. If this young girl isn't a virgin, isn't a good wife, a good mother, a good... I don't know what he promised. I don't know Arabic. At least not very much. You may do this to me. Now that's what Abraham is in the middle of. Now think about it. Yeah, thank you. Somebody caught it. What has God promised that he would do? Descendants, land, indirectly the Messiah. And God is so committed to that, he's ready to stake his life on it. What does Abraham have to do? What do you think Abraham is thinking at this point? Me and my chutzpah. Now, what happens is, in symbol, which you would expect, the text says, as the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness fell over him. Now, you ought to note that phrase, thick and dreadful darkness. That's a Hebrew colloquial expression, which means to be scared out of your mind, terrified. I had a Jewish friend who came to visit us in this country, and it was first time by us. You have to know Middle Easterners have as weird a views of our country as we have of theirs. You say Israel and everybody thinks, you know, when we go there on our tour or something, you have to wear a helmet and we ride around in a tank. And the media has created so much, there's danger, there's no question, but the media has created so much garbage that you can't even explain to people what it's... Well, they have the same thing. You see signs in travel agencies in Israel that say, don't go to Miami. It is not safe to travel to Miami. Israelis are scared to go to death to go to Miami. Miami is the most dangerous place in the whole world. Well, anyway, he had this thing. He had read an article in some newspaper that in northern Michigan there were bears. which I suppose there are some black bears in the Upper Peninsula. But he was scared to death of bears, and I live in the woods in western Michigan. There hasn't been a bear in that wood since the last streaker ran through. It's just, there aren't any bears in our woods. So he, the first thing when he came, he said, well, okay, but are there bears? David, there are no bears. We don't have bears. There aren't any, and if they were, they'd be scared to death of you. Just growl and they'll run away. Okay, so anyway, he came over. Well, you know how, maybe you don't. My wife is this, she's into hospitality. This is her whole world. So when company comes, the whole house gets turned inside out and upside down. My son has to move out of his room because that's a nicer bedroom. We'll let the company stay there because they're going to be here a month. So he moved my son out. Well, my son had won this gigantic big bear, teddy bear, at Great Ohio, Cedar Point. And so my wife said, we can't have that in there. So she put that in the storeroom. It was a tri-level house in the lower level. Just stuck it in the storeroom. So the first night, David got up in the middle of the night, and I had explained to him, you go up one flight of stairs, on your left is the washroom. Well, he got up middle of the night to use the washroom on a different time thing, I suppose. And instead of going up, he went down, made a left, opened the door, and stepped into the storage room and turned on the light. And here's this great big bear. And I heard him go, ah! Like this, right? I come down, this Israeli, who's a lieutenant in the Israeli army, has been in every war you can imagine. He's just white as a sheet. And so David, he said to me, a thick and dreadful darkness fell over me. He said this in Hebrew. For the first time I understood. Listen, Abraham is standing there looking at this blood. He knows if he puts his little toe in the blood and says, if I'm not perfect, you may do this to me, he's a dead man. There will be no descendants, no land, and no Jesus. And guess what? You wouldn't be here today. You wouldn't have any interest in anything Christian. There would never have been a Christ, humanly speaking. And there he stands. Now, in the darkness, two symbols appear. The first is called a smoking fire pot, and the image is smoke. Now, we know that first symbol represents God. Why? Because in a covenant, the greater party always walks first. So the first one into the blood that I saw was the young man's father, because that's the greater party. It's a smoke symbol. By the way, it isn't very good rendering of a fire pot, but I haven't seen it recently, but years ago and in ancient times, the woman would collect the coals. They didn't have bics or matches. They would collect the coals and put them in a clay jar that had all holes poked in it before it was baked. And they would set that outside, and it kind of smokes all night, little tendrils of smoke. I've seen them. And in the morning, they would pour out those coals on some sticks and straw, and they'd have the day's fire. And that's how they perpetuated the fire from one day to the next. Proverbs 31, I love this passage because no one reads it in cultural context. You know Proverbs 31, the godly woman? It says, her fire never goes out. Now, I've heard some interesting sermons on that, which were, by the way, great sermons, but I think they missed the point. The idea is she always takes care of the coals. So the fire pot appears. Now, you need to picture this, and it's hard for me to create this in a classroom as beautiful as this one is. Here's God, and God is saying, Abraham, I love you so much, I'm going to send you descendants, one of whom will be Messiah, and I'm going to give you a place to live out your life in obedience to me. And if I don't keep my word, and Almighty God, in symbol, okay, comes down from heaven and walks barefoot in animal blood to say, I love you. It is an incredible moment. He doesn't say a word. It's all a picture. Now, it's Abraham's turn. By the way, we know in the Bible that smoke is also a symbol of God. Often when God appears, there's smoke. The temple fills with smoke. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke, and so on. The second symbol that appears is a torch. Fire. Now the question is, who does the second symbol stand for? It should be Abraham, but not once in the Bible is fire ever a symbol of a human? What is fire always the symbol of? Or, more broadly speaking, God. Give me examples.
Burning bush.
Burning bush. Fire, the pillar of fire. Our God is the consumer. Now, I want to, thank you. Listen. Here's Abraham. The old man is shaking like a leaf. He raises his foot, knowing that when he touches that blood, not only he doesn't get descendants or land, which is bad enough, but the whole Messiah thing is gone. And as he put his foot down, God put his hand in Abraham's chest and said, "No." And God stepped up and said, "Abraham, if you and your descendants are not perfect, you may do this to me." And at that moment, God sentenced Jesus Christ to death. Because there was no doubt Abraham and his descendants were going to sin. I can see Jesus in heaven watching his father sentence him to die. Not a word, just a picture. Now, for the rest of the Old Testament, all sacrifices, please hear me, were not to forgive sins. People have the idea that in the Old Testament, animal blood forgave sins. It didn't. The five animals you were allowed, follow me a moment, the five animals you were allowed to use were a cow, a goat, a sheep, a ram, a pigeon, and a dove. Same five. And the Jews believed, at least if they knew their own theology, or they believe today, that when you took the animal blood and threw it against the altar, you were saying to God, "You promised you would pay for my sin. Please keep your promise." And that's what animal blood stood for. It reminded them that a long time ago, God said, "I will pay the price for your sin somehow." Now, God was so serious about this that a few books later in the Bible, or 400 years later, he made a